Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Ellie, I was going to say, Ellie, welcome to Dublin, because you've just moved down from beautiful Warren Point in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But you didn't get a good welcome last Thursday night, did you, in the city centre? What happened?
No, I did not. So, unfortunately, I was actually attacked and robbed outside the Tower Street station on Thursday evening.
Tower Street station, just across from Butt Bridge, one of the busiest stations, Dart and Mainline Rail. So what time? Around 7 o'clock. Still bright, obviously.
Yeah, it was still bright.
So what happened?
So I was going into town. I was actually going on a date.
Okay.
After work.
Okay.
And I got the Dart into town and I went out the back exit of Tower Street station, which I always do that. Like, I've always gone out of that exit, and I seen a woman like in the corner of my eye, but I didn't think anything of it.
Right.
And unfortunately, just when I left the station, there must have just been nobody around, so she followed me out the back, and then she came around in front of me, and it looked like she asked me for a letter, but I had my headphones on, so I couldn't really hear what she was saying, and then she just attacked me.
Wow. And you think she was asking for a lighter?
I think so.
Yeah, like, okay.
She put her hand up. It looked like she was asking for a lighter, but I couldn't hear because I had my headphones on. And then I seen her look at my bag and I got a bad vibe immediately.
And you had a coat because it was raining.
Yes, I had. I had my coat over my head, just holding it over my head because it was raining. And then when she attacked me, she just must have pulled my coat over my face because I couldn't see anything.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And was she going for your coat or your bag or both? Or just you?
I think she was going for my bag. I think she used my coat to try and disorientate me. But she was really, really trying to get my bag, but I managed to fight her off.
And of course, the other thing to go for now is headphones.
Yeah.
So you robbed the headphones.
She got those headphones. But I don't even think that was her intent to take them, but they came off during like the scuffle.
Okay.
And she got them as well.
Oh, she got them as well?
Yeah.
So what did she actually steal?
So she got my coat and my headphones.
And your bag, you held onto your bag.
Yeah, I did not let her have my bag.
Steadfastly. And a small bag, big bag, over the shoulder bag.
Yeah, it was just like a shoulder bag.
Yeah.
And yeah.
You weren't gonna part with that.
No, definitely not.
Why? Well, why not? Why should you, says you? But just given that you're so adamant, what was in it that was, if you want to tell me?
Yeah, no, I had like my purse and all and my house keys and everything in it, so she was not getting that.
Where did you head then when you realised your headphones were gone, your coat was gone, you're standing there raining, you're holding onto your bag, probably a little bit bruised as she tried to put it off you. Where did she go?
So she just walked back into the station, and like by the time, because I can't really remember, but I must have crossed the road then at this point, and I think I was in shock. And then I turned around and she started walking back into the back of the station, and people started coming out then, but like nobody seen it. It was just like unfortunate in that one little period of time that I was on my own. So she took advantage of me, and like she scratched me on, well, I don't know if she scratched me, but like I've cut on my face. And like a bruise on the side of my head.
And how long did this attack last? It was an attack. How long did it last for?
Probably, I don't know, maybe around 15, 20 seconds. I can't really remember. I was just in shock.
So did she run away, Ellie?
Did she just walk away?
Any sign of being afraid of being caught?
No, she was not at all.
Wow. Okay, so you're not too far there from Pierce Street Garda Station.
Yeah, so I walked round there and like I was crying a bit because I was just like in shock. And I spoke to a guard outside and he told me to go in and report it. So I did go in and I was waiting in the queue for like half an hour. And I think I was just so like stressed out and all. I just ended up leaving because like I hadn't been seen. And I was going on a date, so I was just like, I think I was just in shock and I left.
And what do you mean there was a queue?
Yeah, there was a queue in the station.
Had it just one hatch open or whatever?
Yeah.
You didn't. Well, probably the best way of asking it. How were you the following morning? Like, should you have gone to a hospital, or were you grand? Not grand, but you were shook, obviously.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I've had a few people say that I should have gone to a hospital, but I don't know. I think I'm just, like, I was so freaked out. I didn't even want to, like, keep thinking about it so much, you know. But, like, I didn't even go into work on the Friday because I was so shook up.
Did you not?
No.
But your coat is gone. Your headphones are gone.
Yeah.
It's raining.
Yeah.
You're crying, understandably. You're walking around to the Garda station. It's one of the busiest in the country. So there's a queue, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I didn't know there would be a queue that long, but there was a queue. And I'm, you have great spirit.
I know. I feel like I keep laughing about it. I don't know if that's healthy.
But it probably is at the end of the day. But were you wet and freezing and shaking and trembling?
No, so the guy I went on a date with, he bought me an umbrella, which is really nice of him.
Who gave you an umbrella? Oh, the guy you were meeting?
Yeah.
Okay. And I won't, you know I don't pry, Ellie. Was it a first date?
No, it was a second date.
Ah,
so
fantastic.
it wasn't as crazy.
Fantastic. But it would, like, he would have got a fright if it had been a first date. If you arrived along.
I know.
Teary-eyed, freezing.
Yeah. And it was raining and they didn't have a coat anymore. So it was good. He bought me an umbrella.
Oh, okay. Well, fair play. Now, more importantly, has this ever happened before? Like, you're not new to cities, obviously.
Yeah. No, I've been living down here for 4 months now.
Okay.
And, like, I would go into town quite often and I always get off at that station and I always go out the back exit.
Okay.
And I've never...
But the back exit is onto a relatively quiet street, isn't it? It's a continuation
of Poolbeg
Street.
I won't be going out the back exit anymore.
Because the front exit brings you right out onto the quayside, the riverside, And they're due to change. That's due to be a major transport hub in the next century, I think, when the metro comes. There's a massive plans for Tara Street. And there's a massive new complex going up across the road. A whole new, probably one of the biggest building projects, apart from the Children's Hospital, in the country. And that's due to open soon. So it's going to be a very busy spot. Did you, and I understand if you didn't. Did you go back to the guards?
No, yeah. I haven't. And I don't know, if I should. Like, I probably should.
Yeah. But as you say, this woman just nonchalantly attacked you.
Yeah.
Try to wrestle your bag off.
She didn't seem like run off or anything. She just walked back into the station
nonchalantly. And what age group was she?
I don't know, maybe 40s.
Yeah. And did she say anything apart from you think? Because you had your headphones on. Give us a lighter.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That was. I'm pretty sure she asked me for a lighter. But that I didn't even hear it because I had my headphones on.
Okay, Ellie. How are you now?
I'm okay now, to be fair. I am a wee bit scared to go back into town, though.
Yeah, well, it's also, you're also warning people as well to always be, you were vigilant, but...
Yeah.
And it's also hopefully saying to people, I know you're making the point again and again that at the time you went out and the spot you went out, there was no one else around. But hopefully if there had been someone around, they might have intervened or shouted or whatever.
Yeah.
No, I hope, oh, good God... But I hope there was no weapon. Did she have?
I know, that's because I was thinking about that afterwards. Like, if she had a weapon or, if she had been far bigger than me or something, who knows what would have happened.
Yeah. Okay. And you didn't go in. Did you tell your job why you didn't go in the next day?
Yeah.
Okay.
I told my manager and he told me it was okay not to go in.
Oh, that's fair play.
Yeah.
That is fair play. And how are you now?
I'm okay now.
Yeah. Okay. I just have warned the people, and I know the Garda are vigilant, and I've often seen them speeding from the back of Pier Street Garda station around into Tara Street, around to the front of Tara Street, because there's been a bit of drug dealing and a bit of carry on, but they seem to be very conscious of it. But anyway, maybe they'll keep an extra eye, especially on that back exit there. Is there any sign of CCTV, I wonder?
I don't even know.
No. I don't expect you to know. Okay, so, but you are. You will stay in Dublin, please.
Yeah, don't worry.
Okay. Next question, third date?
I think so, unless I haven't scared him off.
Well, let's hope it brings you good karma to you, to you and him. You sound. What do you work at, Eddie? What's your skill? Because you have a skill, obviously. You have great communication skill.
I actually work for Ranner on their social team.
Great. On their social team.
Yeah.
Oh, you write it. Who writes those funny tweets?
Well, they're very funny.
They're very funny, and they're always good humoured. I knew Michael O'Leary did. I didn't recognise his handwriting anyway. I knew this. So he has a great team, and I really, and I know you do as well, I really appreciate that your manager in Ryanair said to you, stay at home. That's a nasty thing that's after happening.
Yeah.
Thanks indeed, Eddie. Stay well and stay safe. And the weather now is picking up dramatically, we're told. So hopefully nothing like this will happen again. That's Ellie, originally from Warren Point. Joe at rt.ie, 51551. Obviously a very historic and important day in Tuam as the forensic work, the excavation begins on the location where it is believed there are the remains of 796 infants. Annette McKay. Annette, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you today?
Okay.
And you believe your sister, well, you know your sister, Mary, died there. You believe she is one of the 796?
Yes, she's on the list of the 796.
Yeah.
She died in 1943.
And what was her name and what do we know about her, Annette?
She was born Mary Margaret O'Connor.
Okay.
To my mum, Maggie O'Connor. Mum was taken to industrial school when she was 11. She was sentenced to an industrial school in Galway.
Yeah.
Where she was raped. And then she was sent to Tuam.
And do you know, or have you been able to ascertain even a birth date for baby Mary?
I've got the baby's birth certificate and the death certificate.
Okay, and what does that tell you?
It says the baby was born, as I say, Christmas 1942, and she died in June 1943 of whooping cough and congestive heart failure.
So she was about 6 months old?
Yes.
Okay. So what's your overall feeling today, Annette?
Well, it's a bit unreal, to be honest.
Yeah.
We've been counting down days, a decade of protests and campaigns and commissions and forums and never thinking that it would happen.
Yeah.
And today is the concrete proof it actually is.
Now, they say the team that are involved and are highly professional and they've been working on it a long time now, they say it could take up to 2 years, 24 months.
Yes, I'm on the advisory board.
Okay.
So I met the team in January last year.
Okay.
And so I've obviously had a bird's eye view of what the exhumation will mean, how complicated it is, how difficult it's been, and I'm just wishing Dan and the team well, and I know they're in it, they're very committed, they're talented, and they will do that job.
Yeah. But you... You know there was a workhouse there beforehand, there could be other material as well. Are you... And again, are you prepared for disappointment, Annette?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I've met a scientist from Forensic Science Ireland.
Okay.
Who's explained the difficulties of how obtaining DNA from such small children, you know, babies at six months old, it's going to be extremely difficult. So I am prepared that Mary Margaret might never be found. But for me now, I accept that the success will be, they will all be taken out of there.
Okay. And you want your sister out of there?
Oh my God, yes.
You want her away from that place?
Yes. I had a dream that the baby would be found, identified, and reunited with my mum.
Yeah.
And I could bring her here to England
yeah.
and bury the baby with my mum. And I accept that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
But I now accept that I'll be happy if all those children remain together. Some will be claimed by families.
Yeah.
But they will be out of that terrible, terrible place.
And your mother, Margaret, Maggie, as you call her, Maggie O'Connor, I said she passed away in 2016. Did she often talk about the Bon Secours?
She talked about the nuns because where she was in Galway at Lennaboy Castle is described as one of the worst of the industrial schools, a very cruel, brutal place. So we were brought up as children hearing stories of the nuns. She was terribly traumatised and ill with the damage.
Yeah.
So, but we didn't know about tomb.
And did your mother know about tomb before she passed in terms of the findings and the suspicions of Catherine Corliss?
You know, the terrible thing is I had to be grateful that my mother had dementia
yeah.
and never knew what the fate of that baby had been.
Okay. And you say your mother told you that when she was heavily pregnant as a result of a rape, while she was in care, let me use that word, inadvisedly, she was cleaning floors and the nun kicked your mother.
Yeah, she told me that. And she never really, she told me once about the baby and we were all in shock, as you can imagine, because she was 70 and the first time she ever spoke about Mary Margaret.
Wow.
And she always told me about Lennaboy, but she very, very rarely spoke about Chum. But she remembered the nun kicking her in the stomach.
And how did your mother break free? I mean, even physically, how did she get out of the place? And where? She obviously went to the UK, did she?
Well, they threw her out. The baby died. The day the baby died, they told her to leave. And she came back to Galway and stayed a while with her sisters and then made her way to Belfast, where she met my father.
Yeah.
And then she came to England.
Yeah. Did she ever go back to Galway?
Many, many years later.
Okay.
And we were told that she'd had some difficulty. Well, I now assume that it was an episode of PTSD. She ended up in hospital. And she very rarely went back after that.
You're saying when she visited Galway again, she was overcome and she ended up in hospital?
Yeah, we were told that Maggie's had a migraine attack and she ended up in a psychiatric hospital. And we just accepted these things. We were young we didn't question. But now, you know, I'm a retired psychologist and I understand, obviously, what my mum was dealing with and what had happened to her and the trauma she'd been through, and walking those streets in Galway just meant more trauma.
Yeah. Well, God rest her and God rest your sister, your mother Maggie and Mary. You mentioned Daniel McSweeney. I know he was mentioned earlier on by Catherine Corliss, who I hope we'll be talking to as well in a few minutes. Daniel McSweeney, please stay with us, Annette, because you've met Daniel, obviously. He's the director appointed by the government of authorised intervention in Tuam. Daniel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Thank you for having me on the programme.
And thank you for your work and your team. What has been today been like for you, Daniel? I know it's not the beginning because you've been working on it, but it is a milestone.
Yeah, it's really 2 years of work that we have done to move from preparation to the excavation. So it's meaningful for us, but I think the focus really today should be on the families and the survivors, because for them it's been a much longer journey that they've been on, and people have been searching for answers for a long time. And I think, as Annette said, it is a very challenging moment for them, because yes, they do want this to go ahead, and I think they're happy to hear that it's going ahead. But as you alluded to in your question, there's no certainty that there'll be answers. And in my conversations with families and survivors, this kind of state of mind, I think, is very prevalent.
And you've done a lot of work in not exact similar areas, exact same areas, but in very similar work for the Red Cross and various other organisations. Have you, Daniel, people, when you were appointed, have you received a lot of communication from relatives of people who believe their relatives are buried in Tuam?
Yeah, we have had a lot of communication from people who are interested in providing DNA samples, for example. We've had about 50. We've taken DNA samples from 15 because at the moment, because of the staged process that's in the legislation that governs all of this, we can only take from elderly, vulnerable people now. But we will be in a position to take samples from everybody who's entitled to give samples once the excavation gets up and running.
Okay,
but as the story is more in the media, then I think more people come forward.
Yeah,
we've seen really in the last couple of weeks more people are coming forward.
Well, people will see it. I've already heard a lot about it today, and indeed in the lead up to it. We'll try and get a better line for you, Daniel, given its importance. Catherine Corliss, good afternoon, Catherine.
Good afternoon, Joe, and thank you for having me on again as well. Thank you.
And so many people want to thank you for your perseverance and genuine research at the beginning. Catherine, what's today like for you?
It's a wonderful day for me, Joe, as you can just imagine, after all this time to finally have got this far and to get, to me it's closure for on my part, but I know there'll be a lot of anxious relatives waiting. But at least it's happening, and at least I know that Daniel McSweeney will give it his best shot. He has worked really hard for this, and he'll do absolutely everything he possibly can to get every little bone that's there. And it's sad in a way, but it's for me, it's a great relief altogether, because I never knew what was going to happen or whether it would all fall apart. But I'm quite pleased that this is happening at last.
Okay, and people will hear that, and people will above all hear your care for those babies and indeed the relatives, which is which has always been in your thoughts and your passion and your research from the get-go. But I just want to ask you about, if I can, Catherine, because we will talk to other relatives shortly, so I'll put it in a context. You said recently, and this has been trying for you, because it you're naturally a shy person, but now you're an international figure.
I know, Joe. I don't even know how that happened, because I didn't expect it. I started out with a simple message. There are 796 babies missing. The possibility is they're in that area, in that site in Tuam, and it is a sewage system. And my one message was that there are so many babies, they're in a sewage system, we know it now, and we have to get them out of there. It's not consecrated ground.
Yeah.
They were all baptised. And yet it took this long for people, for the authorities and the church to take it upon themselves to sort this out finally. And that is the shame of it, that it took so, so long for a simple message. It was wrong. And now it's justice for the babies. And that's all I ever wanted to be, was to be a voice for them. And it was a long, long time. But as I say, it's happening. And that's the main thing.
And I know when I say to you, because I think anyone listening can see Catherine Corliss and Aidan, but can see your kitchen. In there, I can see it now in my mind's eye from the television pictures.
The famous kitchen on the range there behind me.
Yeah.
yeah, I know. I had no idea that was going to go this far. And I appreciate relatives and other people who pressed for the DNA testing and for the forensic side of it. Now, there was a lot of groups that wanted that. I had never dreamt that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful that it's all come together and it is happening.
But you also said you think it is the end of a journey for you.
Well, for me, yes. I know it's only beginning for Annette McKay and other people who are waiting to see, can they possibly get their own little sister back. I mean, and that would be enormous for them. I realise that, and they fought hard for that end of it.
Even though Annette said earlier, well, in her message, Annette, that even if it is only a thimbleful of remains of baby
Mary. I can imagine that.
Yeah,
God love them. I can imagine how it is for them, and it's an anxious wait for them from this stage on. But at least everyone's doing their best to retrieve those remains. Yeah. And it's going to be done so calmly and delicately that I know that Daniel said he doesn't want any evidence to be destroyed, and he's gone to extremes to ensure that it will happen, because it is slow and it will be painstakingly slow to get every little bone. Yeah.
Okay, I'll get back to Daniel in a sec, but I want to bring in another relative, Anna. Anna Corrigan. Anna, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Can you hear me?
I can, loud and clear. I don't know if you're on a speakerphone, but if you are, just...
I will, I'll check it out.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay,
Who's, of course, Anna, no, don't be worried. Anna, your brother John Desmond Dolan.
Yes.
When did he die? What do we know about him?
John Desmond Dolan was born in 1946, and he died in the home of Chum in 1947, 16 months old. And he's on the death list for the 796. And he was born normal and healthy. Sorry, are you getting feedback, Joe?
No, I'm not. No, but I, if you are, we'll try.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Okay.
He was born normal and healthy, and then I got the inspection report on the home, and he was 13 months old, and he's listed on the inspection report as being emaciated with a voracious appetite and no control over bodily functions. Now, I mean, emaciated to me, in my interpretation of English, it's starved, and a voracious appetite means you're very hungry.
Yeah.
So the two words you don't juxtapose to each other. Now, I found it subsequently that my mother had left the home, but she was sending back 5 shillings a month for his upkeep, and the nuns were also receiving a stipend from the county council. So there's no reason why he should be hungry or starving. It also said that he possibly had mental issues, but when I went looking for medical records from the doctor who operated in the home on behalf of the county council, and the nuns, who were all nursing nuns, they had no record of this child deteriorating from birth to 13 months old in this condition. And then he died subsequently at 16 months old from the measles, and they put on the end that he was congenital idiot.
My God. That phrase.
Congenital idiot.
Okay.
So that's on my brother John, and he's on the list. I also have a brother William who was born there.
Yeah.
And William was born in 1950, and he purported to have died there in 1951. But there is no death certificate for him. There's no reason for death, no medical certification of death. The only thing I have to say he said is it's written in the ledger by the nuns dead and the date, and he's not on the list of the 796. So both those cases lie with the police in Tuam since 2013 and 2014. Mm-hmm. And I subsequently went on to set up the Tuam Babies Family Group to aid and assist survivors.
Okay, your line is running away. Running away on his honour. We're going to try and improve that one as well. But I go back to Daniel, Daniel McSweeney. Daniel, when did you? I presume you had to inform the relatives that the actual physical work was going to begin.
Yeah. So we've been in regular contact with the groups, like Anna's group, survivors groups, families groups, and then with individuals who've contacted us. So we do inform them in advance of any news so that they hear it from us rather than from the media. That's something that we try and do.
Yeah.
So, for example, when we announced the date that the excavation would begin, I called Catherine and Anna that morning, and I called Annette the night before. So that's how we try and operate. Now, it's not always going to be possible to do it like that, but that's certainly how we do it. So, I mean, from the very start, and this is something I know from my Red Cross experience, you have to have the families at the center of the work. So we have a family liaison person, and we will try and accompany them all the way through the process, in the knowledge that it is very, very, it's a very, very difficult and anxious process for them, and that's how we try and try and do it. But we also try and accompany the Tuam community through this, and particularly those people who live near the site, because they're obviously going to be affected by the fact that there's this big building site in some ways, and very sensitive site in other ways, that's right behind their houses.
And is it been treated, given I saw the pictures earlier of the hoarding going up, and I saw the same type of hoarding going up around the Anna McCarrick suspect site as well, a house that maybe she had been brought to at one stage. Is it a crime scene?
Well, we'll treat it like the guards would treat it as an investigation scene. So it's a forensic recovery rather than, for example, an archaeological recovery.
Okay.
So we will treat it with that level of carefulness, so that we ensure that we find everything and we document everything that we find. And this will then, you know, maximize the chances of identification of, if there are commingled sets of remains, which we believe that they are, of separating them out and individualizing them, and then establishing, if we can, causes and circumstances of death. So the care to which we go in the recovery will aid us in trying to achieve those objectives. So, and this is why it's taken this length of time to prepare, because we really have to have the right procedures, we have to have the right people, and we really have, I think, excellent people. We have to have the right plans, and we've really been busy putting all of those things in place over the last couple of years.
I'm also conscious that, it is over a decade, and then we're also dealing with going back to 1925 and being, and from there on. But I presume in the world we now live in that, or maybe it's not, that forensic equipment and analysis has improved dramatically, or just improved.
I mean, of course, forensics as a discipline has improved enormously over the last number of decades. However, we are dealing with a very unusual situation, which is infants' remains that have been buried, you know, up to 100 years ago. And obviously, it's the west of Ireland. It's Ireland. It's very, very wet. So one of the challenges will be figuring out, recovering whether or not there is a sufficient DNA in these remains to actually make an identification.
Yeah.
And that's something we won't really know until we've recovered the remains and examined them ourselves. So the identification part, the complexity and the difficulty of it shouldn't really be underestimated. And then there's the question of how many relatives come forward.
Yeah.
And as I said, around 50 have at the moment. We hope that more will. But that the number of relatives that comes forward is really the limit of the number of identifications we could possibly have. But we hope that more will come forward, but we obviously understand if some people don't want to come forward, we have to respect those wishes as well.
But there also might be people who are unaware of their connection.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a possibility, and I think if people think they might have a connection to Tuam, they should feel free to contact us.
Okay.
You know, our website has information, which is odait.ie. We have a phone number, which is 01-5391-777. And we have an email address, info@dait.ie. So if people believe they might have a relative buried at the Tuam site, and they are interested in providing DNA, then if they can please get in touch with us, we'd be very happy to talk to them.
And once the excavation gets underway, how many people will be on the site? Now, I'm also conscious that you can't have too many, because it's such a sensitive, painstaking work. You don't want people trampling all over the place. How many will you have on site?
When we're up to our full complement, we'll have 18. So we'll have two teams who will be able to work in two parts of the site at the same time.
Right.
Because it's a huge site. I mean, everybody is familiar with what's called the Memorial Garden, which is this walled, grassy area. Yeah. That's a fraction of the full site. The full site is about 5,000 square meters. So we'll have our 18 people, and then there will be four or five from the builder who's working with us, okay. And then likely others from time to time, depending on what's going on. Now, when we start, we won't have the full 18. We'll build up to that over a number of months. But we will have ultimately anywhere between sort of 15 to 30 people on site at any given time.
Okay.
And then we will sort of methodically move through the site in a planned way.
Daniel, I'm conscious of the important work you have to do. But if you can stay with us, please do. Joe Edward, and Annette and Catherine and Anna. Joe at rte.ie 51551.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'll go back to Anna. Anna is back there now. Anna Corrigan, as you were telling us earlier, two of your siblings, when did Judas are buried there, died there in unexplained circumstances, to say the least. Anna, when did you become aware that you had two older brothers?
I only became aware in 2012.
Okay.
I was researching my father's time in the industrial homes,
right.
And I mentioned to the lady in Bernardo's who was doing the tracing that I had some inkling, or I don't know, was a dream, or did I remember, or did I hear something when I was very young about my mother having two children? And she said, tell me her name and I'll check it up for you. And she came back Christmas 2012 and told me that my mother had given birth to two boys in Tube.
Oh God, well, that was news to you.
Shock, horror. I was reared an only child, and by two survivors of the home. Now I know my father was in the industrial homes, my mother was in Tuam.
And two of your siblings are buried there.
Well, I'm not sure, Joe, that they're buried there, because both of the cases of my brothers are with the police in Tuam since 2013 and 2014. I made a complaint that because William doesn't have a death certificate, he's a missing person, I have no reason for death, medical certification of death.
Yeah.
And I also contend, given the records that I found about John, that he died of neglect and malnutrition.
Okay.
So
Which
is a crime, and so is a missing person, because a seven-month-old baby can't walk out of some place and just disappears. So somebody secreted him or something happened to him.
And Anna, Daniel, I presume he was referring to you. Daniel said he rang. You got that phone call from Daniel last week to say the excavation was going to begin. What was your reaction to that?
A light at the end of the tunnel. I also had set up the Tuam Babies family group for people who have family in the grave. So I think we're the only stated group so far that we have 14 combined of our family members purported to be in the pit. And so when we got the confirmation, I became somewhat similar to Annette there. I became very traumatized because I'd spent 10 years wearing armor and fighting and nothing but fighting and obfuscation and prevarication and you name it. And when I took it off and I seen my wounds and I realized what had happened, it was a very, very emotional day for me.
Yeah. And Anna, and I'll ask Annette as well, I presume, given the sensitivity, would the families like to go and at some stage see the work that's going on, see the excavation?
Well, the families in the group are resident in the United States, and they're also in England. So they have given me permission to speak on their behalf, and their names are lodged with my solicitor.
Yeah, okay.
So I have sent the word out to them, and it's of their own choice if they decide to come over. But I haven't got any response to it as yet.
Yeah, so it's early there. And Daniel, will that be facilitated? That at some you can't do it every day, but would there be an agreed date where people, relatives can come and see, because the barriers obviously will be up and no one will be able to view it from outside the area. But would there be a day when families, if they wish, can come?
Yeah, Joe. So we have decided to have a visit for families and survivors on the 8th of July, so just before the full excavation begins. Now, The site is, as of today, under forensic control. So, as I said, it is treated like a Garda investigation scene. So we won't be able to bring people onto the site. We'll bring them to the perimeter of the site and we'll be able to show them what it looks like now. And then we will have them meet with our forensic staff and we'll explain to them then in greater detail the process that will then take place.
Okay.
So that's the 8th of July. But as I said, the site, as of today, is no longer open to the public. So we did advise family members, survivors, and anyone who wants to go and visit the site to do so by yesterday. And I know a lot of people did do that. And as I said, we'll then, on a monthly basis throughout the process of the excavation, we'll then be updating people on what we found.
Okay. Catherine, you'll obviously, it will be kept and will keep up to date on what's happening. But as you say, it is a milestone for you. It is the end. It's the beginning, but the end of the beginning for you, and that's really important.
It is, Joe. Yeah, it's closure for me at this stage. But I am very much aware of the relatives of babies who are there. They will be waiting and hoping, and I do hope that they will be able to retrieve the little remains. I know it's possible from talking to Daniel. It is possible in a lot of cases where they will get the DNA for when the babies aren't just a few weeks old, and that it will be easier for the the older babies and the toddlers and that. And there are quite a lot of babies there between 1 year and two. I think that's the biggest number, because from the death certs, there's a lot of 1.5, 18 months and up to 2 years old. So hopefully they'll be able to get something from that. But it is a very emotional day and it's very sad in another way. But as I said, it was something that just had to happen. So I just feel that I was given this task from somewhere, I don't know where, but I'm glad I did, and I'm happy about the whole procedure of it, how it's going, and it's going to be, hopefully it'll turn out well.
Absolutely. Mandy, all rest in eternal peace. Catherine Carlos, Daniel McSweeney, the Director of Authorised Intervention, Annette McKay and Anna Corrigan. Thank you all. Joe at RTE.ie. Grainne Brady. Grainne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. And one of the most valuable things in Ireland at the minute is your empty bottles, plastic bottles, and indeed cans, because there's a deposit on them. And so many, you had an idea to collect them.
We did. We got the returnable scheme, big orange bins that you'll see around the country at the moment. And we thought this would be great. We're trying to develop our club amenities at the moment, so there's no spare cash available at the moment. So we thought we'd put this towards the juvenile fund to buy balls and equipment and all the such that you need and everyday costs for the juvenile running. And they were all took on us, gone.
So supporters of the club are bringing, instead of going directly to the return machines at supermarkets and petrol stations or whatever, where they get their receipt out and get their money back. It all happens very quickly now, I'm told. Well, I did it last week myself. It did happen very quickly. Instead of going, they bring them to the local club. They put them into a big bin, but it's an open bin, obviously. And then you bring the bin. Well, what do you do with the cans and the bottles? Because they're becoming very valuable.
They are. So it's a bin and it's like a lock. It's like your normal day that you get on your ESB, key. And they're locked that way and you can't reach in and take the bottles out. You have, after games, a few volunteers are going around picking up empty bottles that are left lying about. And then you have your all the young ones, they're bringing their empties to it and putting it in the bin as well. Just all in an effort just to save a few pounds and collect money for the juveniles and towards club expenses for the juveniles, for equipment and such.
And we also know that another report today from the business group that does great work about our cities, same spaces unfortunately are mentioned every year, but the same positive areas are mentioned. Another positive this year, there has been a decrease in the number of empty cans and bottles that are discarded. But now people know that they are valuable, And you know, yeah, do you know how they were, like, would it take much to break the lock?
No, especially if it's just, I think, as far as I'm aware, it's just one of the normal keys, like to open an ESB box or a radiator or something you know. So it's not that difficult to open it. You could take this to walk by and put your hand in it. You can't, it'd be difficult to do it that way. But the person that took it from us and stole our bottles, he seemed to have a key and was just able to lift the lid and take the bag out into the back of the car, and away he went.
So if many of these bins are around the country now, they're targets because they're
valuable.
They are,
yeah. They are. Well, we have four bins altogether on our grounds, and one in a specific busy area was completely full, and then you had some in all the rest of them. So this guy, there was one down the very bottom of the grounds, and he spotted it, and he still jumped the fence and went and took that one as well. Like, you know, he wasn't leaving. He was making sure he had them all before he left.
So he was a lone ranger. He was alone.
He was, yeah.
Okay.
He was. And since we put our post up on Facebook.
Yeah, but where did you put the bottles and the cans?
He put them in the back of his car, in the boot of the car. Filled the car and away he went.
And his car was worth how much more when with the bottles and the cans and the boot? A few hundred quid.
Yeah.
So his plan then is to he'll see it as legitimate. Even though he sold and it is property because it is valuable. Previously, it wouldn't have been regarded as property because it had no intrinsic value. Now they have an intrinsic value because of the return scheme. So he would then go to a machine, probably in the middle of the night, and stand there and tread each bottle in one by one.
Yes. Yeah.
And when you get those return bins, do return collect them directly?
Yeah. So we just get them filled up. We only have them 6 to 8 weeks now at this stage, so we never got a chance to get them emptied.
But they come and empty them. That's how you get your fundraiser money. And you say the key was like, what is it, a generic key, like an all key or whatever that you'd use on a...
It wouldn't be... I don't think it's too difficult now to come by.
And is there any facility for ERA, OAG, GAA and Smithsboro and Monaghan to buy a stronger lock? Is there any facility to put it on?
Well, there is. We've been researching that and you can buy straps for wheelie bins to keep them locked. But at the same time, you know, it's like everything else. You can cut the straps or you can break the chains, and you know, if you're determined enough, you can do it. But look, it'd be a bit more hassle, so it might be a bit more of a deterrent. But it's more of a, it's not a huge cost, but it's still a cost to have to go and do this to your bins when you shouldn't have to, you know.
What a load of rubbish your mum is up to. But the problem now is the challenge now is that it is valuable and it is reducing the number of bottles and cans that are discarded. Bottles and cans are discarded, as you say, you just go around and collect them and put them in the bin. They'll do it at the festivals this weekend or the Beyond the Pale yesterday.
But since we released our Facebook post, it has other clubs have come in touch with us and said that the same thing, and the same person has been doing it to a number of clubs throughout the county. So some of them have got a lot more talk off them than us, worth a lot more
money.
So like he's making a few bob on it, so he is.
The can snatcher.
The
mysterious. And by the way, was his face covered on CCTV?
No.
Okay. Brazen as you like.
No, he's walking around. Quarter past one in the day. Not a bother. And jumped the fence and everything when he spotted the other bin and took a run down the field and made sure to get them all.
Okay. Well, as you say, they are valuable. Okay. Will you keep going with this fundraising scheme?
We will, I presume. Of course we will. There's not everyone... Look... It has happened. We hope it won't happen again. Okay. I don't think our mystery caller will reappear to our area again, hopefully. So, you know, we'll just keep going with it and hopefully everybody will keep bringing their cans and bottles. And by the end of the year, we'll fundraise enough to keep the juveniles going with their balls and equipment.
Okay. Great, great, great effort, but also a good fundraising scheme. Gráinne Brady, thanks to the Gráinne. Gráinne is in Monaghan. Up Éire Óg, come on Éire Óg.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
In any event, we found that the interest aroused by this book has exceeded our wildest expectations. We have now produced over 4 million copies, 7 editions in the United States, translations into Danish, French, Finnish, German, Italian, Japanese, Norwegian, Spanish and Swedish. This is the introduction by Ivy. This is how Lord Ivy would sign themselves in those days, just Ivy, to the 1968 edition, the 15th edition of the Guinness Book of Records. And as you heard with Katie on Friday, there is a group in Castlebridge where the Guinness Book of Records actually began, and it was almost a bet between a challenge between a number of people about what was the longest this and the tallest that, and that became the Guinness Book of Records. Castlebridge is a beautiful town just beyond Wexford Slobs, the wonderful area for viewing wildlife. You come in on the left, the right hand side is the magnificent water mill, and there's a pub, and there is a restaurant, and then you swing around sharp left, and then you see Lowney's. It's been there for many a long year. Lowney's furniture store. I think it's the biggest store in the village. And the reason I always knew Lowney's was I always thought that Declan Lowney, the award-winning director of Father Ted and many, 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 many movies, and still going, Ted Lasso now, strength to strength. I thought Declan Downey was one of the Lowneys, but maybe he's not. But I know he's from that general area. And John Ryan of Castlebridge. John, good afternoon, is on again with us. John.
Hello, how are you going?
How are you getting on in Castlebridge?
Good, good. We're doing well. And as you know, we're out looking for the last few books now. So as you speak, we're getting closer to our magic 70 number. And okay. Looks like we've only got about 10 more to go.
Oh, wow. So just remind people, listeners, what you hope to do in Castlebridge in the sunny southeast.
I guess it's all about really how it started. We are the origin story, as you said, for the Guinness Book Records. And it started as an argument, in fact, and the MD of Guinness, then Sir Hugh Beaver, at the end of that argument, he concluded we need to have a book. And that's the book that has gone on to inspire many people. So we felt it was appropriate to bring all the books together.
Excellent.
You know, because they are the source, of, you know, they are the result of that inspiration. And put them on a bookshelf so that people, if you like, they'll have a big collage of books that they can, you know, come along and see, and under a beautiful array of colours, and you know, get a nice photograph there, and you know, feel what those books have mean, and you know, the change that they've done in the world.
And they are an incredible record. And I have, do you know of any other museum or library that has the complete collection? And the complete collection will be in many at this stage.
Yeah, look, there are a lot more. Yeah, we're only novices. I don't know the exact number, but there is a world record for the most number of Guinness World Record books, because there are several other editions. There's gamer editions. There's special Christmas editions. There's technology. There's sports editions. So we'll get
it's
into
an
them
industry,
at
yeah.
this stage. Yeah, we just want the years. We just want to get one per each year now at this stage.
I wondered. So what years are we missing now, so to speak?
So very quickly, 57, 59, 61, 63, 74, 80, 94, 96, 2006, 2022, and I think we have 2025. We have to buy that one. So
yeah, that's still in the show. Well, there's four now that should be easy to remember, because they're odd numbers. 19, obviously. 1957, 1959, 1961 and 1963. Have you got a copy of the Guinness Book of Records from that year? Would you be willing to donate it to this fantastic project, to the beautiful village of Castlebridge in South County Wexford, where the whole idea began? and they will put them on display because it will be a great collection. Now, it would be also brilliant if we got 74, 80, 94, 96, and 2022 should be easily got at this stage, but the older ones will be harder. 5, 7, 5, 9, 61, 63, 74, 80, 94, 96, going back nearly 30 years there. Would there be, is there any attempt to digitise them?
Look, the records themselves have gone very digital. You know, okay. It's all about TikTok and Twitter and Facebook these days. That's where people are consuming the records in reality. The books are still there. And, you know, I think they still are to go back to. You know, they still are a favourite, you know, for some kids at Christmas time as well. So definitely the books will remain on.
It's always a bestseller at Christmas. It was in Ireland and abroad. It was always number one around Christmas time. Peter, we have 1980 for you now, John. Hold on there. Peter, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. Where are you?
Where am I? I'm in Dublin at present, but I've spent a lot of time down in Kirklaw. We've got a lovely mobile home down.
Beautiful, beautiful, right? Beautiful. Okay. And what year have you got?
Well, just a background to the story, Joe. We have a mobile down there, believe it or not, for 50 years.
Yeah.
And we don't have an awful lot of material, reading material around there. We've too much else to be doing in that beautiful part of the country. But we happen to have one book on the coffee table. It's there for about 30 years. It happens to be a 1980 copy of the Guinness Book. Haven't got around to reading it all yet, Joe.
I know, I'm breaking any of the records. Well, then final question, I'm putting you on the spot now, Peter. Would you be prepared to drive down, it's not a long journey, is it, from Kirklaw to Castlebridge? Would you be prepared to donate it to this wonderful project?
I will have it down with you within the next 7 days, Joe. I'll drop it to Castlebridge.
Okay, excellent, excellent.
You can drop it all in the mill coffee shop.
Is that big red water mill, isn't it? Beautiful, beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Okay, the mill coffee shop. Excellent, excellent.
We do, Joe.
Okay, well done, Peter. Go to Mila Mahogany. Edward Lynch. Edward, what have you got?
Joseph, how are you?
Good.
I think I have what you're looking for. I have my hand here on the 1961 edition.
Ah, brilliant. Right. So 59, 61, great.
I have 20 more after that. Practically everyone. I'd have to go inside to check dates are on it.
You have 20 of them?
I have 20 of them, yeah. I collected them for years, but in the last 20 years or so, I gave up because they got very tabloid. I loved the original ones because they're the longest, the shortest, the tallest, and all that sort of thing, you know.
And what do you mean they went tabloid on it?
They've gone all sorts of things. How many balloons can the fella blow up and all this sort of thing? But it was a Wikipedia at the time.
Yes.
What I did during the year, often there'd be things in the paper and such and such a thing as a record, and I'd check and I'd take the cutting out of the paper. And for a look at me here, and I have this 200 and something pages of the book, and I have at least 50 cuttings, I'd say, and I'm correcting the book. Not correcting, but updating the book, you know. It was Lord Ivy, as your previous speaker said, who apparently after a shoot, he was having an argument over after dinner, and he said, I wonder what's the record for grouse shot in a day and pheasant shot in a day.
Yeah.
And they got on to one of their men in London, Chris Chataway. You remember he was a runner.
Yes,
and
of course.
He was a sportsman, and he got on to Norris and Ross McWhirter, twins. And they were sports journalists, but they were encyclopedic at that stage. As I said, they were the walking Wikipedias of the time. And they compiled it for years until poor Ross was shot by the IRA some years later,
By
apparently, I didn't realise it until lately that by two of the Balcombe Street people, they were convicted over his murder. But I've had it for years, and I find it a fascinating book, and I often used to go back as a kid, but now I reach for Wikipedia when I'm compiling quizzes and things like that.
I found it useful recently. I was asked to make a large birthday card for someone who was 30, and I wanted to put different facts and figures on it. And you go back and get you can get the number one singles and who was Taoiseach. But I went back to and I got a 1995 edition of the Guinness Book of Records. And I said, in that year, the longest jump was, the highest tree was, the number of balloons that you could fit into a mini miner was. And it was just Morris Minor even. It was just full of all those fascinating not entirely used to stats, but it is a great serendipity and curiosity of life.
The one that struck me, and I actually looked it up today when you rang back to say to have me on here, and the one that stuck in my memory for the last 60 years was about the quickest canonization was of St. Peter the Martyr from Verona.
Okay.
He was murdered in 1252. He was unable to speak, but he dipped his finger in his blood and he wrote Credo in Deum on the dusty road, and he was canonized the following year. And then the poor devil, St. Bernard of Tyrone, he was made a saint 744 years later. So you have the earliest sainthood and the latest, the longest sainthood. You know, it's full of all sorts of things, and it's beautiful, beautiful stuff. But as I say, I think they've got a bit tabloid, but I have those. But I'd be definitely willing to donate, and no problem. You realise, Joe, that it's actually in the Guinness Book of Records, is in the Guinness Book of Records as the most stolen book in British libraries.
Brilliant, brilliant.
You know, so
it holds the Guinness Book of Records.
It holds the Guinness Book of Records for having the biggest amount of books stolen. That is the handiest book to pick up and bring it out. But it's a fascinating book.
It's a big tome now to get under your anorak.
It is. You might go in with a big jacket or something like that and get a few of them, you know. But I'd be quite willing to next time I'm down Wexford Way, I'll drop in any if they want it. You can give them a number there and they can give you a tinkle. And
okay.
I'll check inside. I have 20 of them there and they're more than welcome to the gaps in
brilliant.
It. You know?
This is brilliant.
How's it going with you? You only 12 more sleeps left.
12 more sleeps. Only 12 more masses to go to before I finish on Friday week.
we'll miss you. I was actually talking to you there a few months ago about the bubble car from Navan.
Ah, magic.
Some time ago. But anyway, you're an institution.
Should be an institution.
Okay. Possibly put into one.
Okay, you're very kind, Edward. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Sinead Hamill, Sinead.
How are you doing, Joe? How are
good.
You?
Good. You were in the Guinness Book of Records.
I am. So in 2018, a neighbour of mine, Deirdre Featherston, had cancer many years ago. And she decided at the time to set up a strip and dip, which is basically women getting naked, only women, getting naked and going into the sea to raise money for Avian's Pink Tie.
Brilliant.
So it started off with about 60 people, like, you know, her friends, her mum, who I think was 83 at the time, and a load of people like that. And then eventually, after a few years, Deirdre said, do you know what would happen if everybody who came to this were to bring another four or five people? We could probably break the record. And the record at the time, I think, now I could have the number wrong, but it was around 790 or something like that, was in Perth in Western Australia. So good woman D said, we can do better in Ireland, even if we have the rubbish weather. And so it was 2,505 women got into the sea naked and managed to raise a fortune for Avian's Pink Tie. And we actually ended up building a house. It's just down from Crumlin Hospital, actually, called Avian's Lighthouse, where if what Avian's Pink Tie do, I don't know if you're aware of them.
Wonderful charity.
So they give practical help to families whose children have been diagnosed going through cancer. It's a horrible time, obviously. And we ended up raising so much money that particular year that we were able to build a house for them that, you know, people can stay in, and it was fabulous.
And you remember, how did a Guinness Book of Records, how did they verify the number?
So they had a lady there, a lovely lady, I think she was Italian, she was the only one with clothes on.
She stood out.
And she did, actually. And she was a lovely lady, and she came in and verified it and had official timers and everything, and there was a big klaxon sounded, and, like, you know, we'd have, like, Deirdre is very good at organising, because the strip and dip happens every year for the last, whatever, I think it's 12 years now, and she'd have people, women, in kayaks out, you know, at the fire line, so nobody can go out past the kayaks in case, you know, if anybody got nervous or had a cramp or something in the water, they're looked after, and there's, you know, stewards and that, women again, who would be there to help if anybody got into any difficulty. But, like, people really, they go up to their kind of chest, you know. Yeah. Some people
now,
only go up their ankles.
Sinead, do you still hold the record?
We do.
Oh,
because
wow.
Apparently, Perth, and when we broke the record for the strip and dip in 2018, it featured all over the world. It was on, you know, the ticker tape thing in New York where they
Times Square.
And Perth, of course, got wind of it because it was in the newspapers out in Australia. And they said, come on, we can beat this. We can beat the Irish. And I think it was the following year, it must have been, because it was before COVID hit, they tried to break it. And I think they got it maybe 1,500 or something like that. And then they officially conceded.
they threw in the 970 towels and said, we can't do. Now, this is Perth, where normally, well, it's on those different seasons. But I presume the weather in Perth was a lot
better than
Wicklow.
Yeah, slightly. Now, to be fair, the day we did it in 2018 was lovely weather. But this year we did it and it lashed rain before we even went down to the beach. But, Joe, I hope you don't mind. Can I just give a plug to people if they want
to donate? Yeah.
It's www.idonate.ie/strip and dip. Because I think we've raised about this so far this year about 84,000, and we'd love to get over the 100,000 because you know it is a super work that this charity does, and we do it every year. And Deirdre is already, I was only talking to her earlier, she's planning on what possible other world record we might be able to beat next year, but I can't give you the details of that yet.
Okay, but it's. It's a great idea. It's a great bit of fun. Yeah. It's a great bit of fun fundraising.
Super fun, Joe. And people go into the water and come out completely different. Like women who've had double mastectomies. I remember one woman had never let her husband even see her scars. And she stripped off and she's a different woman when she came out of the water. Brilliant. So it's brilliant.
Well, when you think of it, they must be wimps in Perth, are they?
Absolutely.
They couldn't. The water, we'd like a sauna down there getting into the water.
Absolutely. Plus the fact that they were, you know, regular women or whatever, the majority of the women that get into the water with us have been through cancer and might have one breast or no breast or whatever, or one woman had no colon and, you know, I remember she had written across her back, no colon, still rolling. So the attitude is just phenomenal.
Well, I don't know much about Australia, but I do know a lot about Ireland. And one of the great things we have is volunteerism and people helping each other out and community.
Absolutely.
And it's through people like yourself and the tonic and the incentive you generate and the embrace. It's just something to be celebrated again and again, especially in these awful times. Good evening, Margaret, Sinead Hamill, and congratulations again. John Ryan, what are we still looking for? Johnny, quick. Do we know?
We're going to do the Cayley World Record at Wexford Park during the Blah this year. So sign up on inspiresite.org if you'd like to come along.
But how many Guinness Book years are we missing still, I wonder? We have to get a few.
Let me just, we're down to 8 now, I believe.
Oh, brilliant. So, brilliant. 8 out. That's good. That's good going. Yeah. And if you are passing, it's the Red Mill. Coffee shop, it's a lovely coffee shop actually. As you go into Castlebridge, and also the details.
And look for Mairead Stafford.
Okay, well done, John.